Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest on today's show is Anna Wharton, talking about her novel, The Imposter. We'll also hear from Anstey Harris. She'll be chatting about her novel, Where We Belong. And we'll be talking to Louis Elsher about his book, Traitors or Patriots, about the resistance in Germany to the Nazis during World War II. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Anna. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you.
We'll be talking about your novel today, but you, just looking at your CV, you've worked as a journalist, been involved in many publications. It's always been words for you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I started at the Peterborough Evening Telegraph, actually, when I was about 18 years old. So, yeah, 26-year career with words.
Amongst the many things you've done, you've ghostwritten things as well, which I always think sounds fascinating. What's the process of that? How did you get into that and how do you go about it?
The first book that I did was in 2014. And obviously as a feature writer on a newspaper or an editor on a newspaper, I had never written anything to length. And I, to be honest, lots of us have this burning ambition to write a book, but I don't know. It was like putting a huge big roast dinner in front of me and expecting me to enjoy eating it. It felt like such a big task, you know, to write a whole book. And then I came across a story of a woman called Jo Milne, who was born deaf and then started to lose her sight. And then she had cochlear implants. So she heard for the first time when she was about 38 years old. I mean, imagine never having heard birds singing, never having heard your own mother's voice. You know, it was such an incredible story. So I ghosted her book. And then it was as I finished that I thought, oh, I can write to length. and that it was at that point actually that I conceived the idea of The Imposter way back in 2014. And then I went on to I moved out of journalism and into books, into ghosting. So that's my main bread and butter work now, the ghosting.
And with the ghosting, you're putting on somebody else's voice, I guess, which probably feeds into the novel writing, but your ego has to take a back seat.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you have to write as if you are that person, and the relationship between the ghost and the author is a very intimate one, because often people are telling you things that they've never told their nearest and dearest, and you often have to ask them far more than you actually need, but you need to know them so well to write as them. It's an interesting job, and it's nice because you become an expert in these subjects while you're writing about them. So, for example, I did a book, I think it was in about 2015, 2016, about FGM, and I ghosted a book by Hebo Wodari called Cut. And that was a kind of part polemic, part memoir. So I interviewed gynecologists and obstetricians and human rights lawyers and psychologists and police. And, you know, you just become an expert in that field. So I tend to write strong women's voices, women's activism. Yeah, and just things that are interesting to me. I mean, I'm lucky that I am able to pick and choose my projects, you know, to date, touch wood. Yeah, so it's really interesting. So I just find the subjects I'm drawn to, or I don't know much about, or scare me in the case of dementia. And, you know, the books that I did, Somebody I Used to Know with Wendy Mitchell. And then I can write about them.
And we'll be talking about your debut novel, which picks up actually on the theme of dementia there. But we'll listen to your first choice of music in just a moment. Is music important to you, Anna?
Yeah, it's definitely important, but it was making me smile while I was making these choices, because I have to write in absolute silence. I cannot have any sound at all. I can't have like a TV on the background or my daughter running around. I can't have the radio on. I have to be completely silent. So yes, music really important to me.
But not while you're working. And what about this choice? This is Oh Well by Fleetwood Mac. Why this one?
Fleetwood Mac are just incredible musicians, and I was liken it really to writing in terms of the writer's journey being a marathon and not sprint. And look how these guys have evolved over the years. I mean, this particular track is from the very, I think it's from the early 60s. I mean, they were making this great music. We know, perhaps, you know, we're more familiar with the stuff they were doing in the 80s or late 70s. But actually, way back, they were doing this great stuff. And then look how they've adapted over the years. And I would like to think that in my career as a writer, I've done lots of different types of writing, and I will continue to do so.
I can't help about the shape I'm in. I can't sing, I ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. But don't ask me what I think of you. I might not give the answers that you want me to.
And that was Oh Well by Fleetwood Mac, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Anna Wharton. Anna has been a print and broadcast journalist for more than 20 years. She's written for The Times, The Guardian, The Sunday Times, and was executive editor of The Daily Mail. She's ghostwritten four memoirs, as we've heard, including the Sunday Times bestseller Somebody I Used to Know and Cut, One Woman's Fight Against FGM in Britain Today, which was longlisted for the Orwell Prize. The Imposter is her debut novel. Good housekeeping said of it, it keeps you guessing about the characters until the last page. And the Literary Review said it takes the perennial theme of a missing child and makes something unfamiliar from it. I very much enjoyed this as well. It really is a page turner. And you sort of alluded there in the introduction, Anna, to the journey that got you to The Imposter. Was it always inevitable that you would write fiction?
Not sure, really. Like I said, I did resist it for a long time. But when I think about when I was a child, I was always writing stories, and I just think it took me a while to get around to them. And when you have a career in newspapers, it's just so busy, there isn't any time for any kind of creativity in that way. I think really it was having my daughter that made me stop and reassess where I wanted to go, what I wanted to do, and gave me that time, like it does for a lot of women, actually, you know, that maternity leave, and you're really busy in a different way. I don't know why that made such a difference. You can't even read a book anymore. But, you know, yeah, I think that it probably was inevitable, yeah.
And for people who haven't read The Imposter, what's it about, without giving too much away?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? It's the story of Chloe, who is a young woman who works in a newspaper archive, filing away the cuttings of the stories that go into the newspaper. And she is an interesting character. She becomes rather attached to one story in particular. And this happens when her nan has dementia and she goes into a nursing home. And so Chloe feels a little lost at sea at that point, and she falls into this story of a girl called Angela Kyle who went missing 25 years ago, and her parents make appeals in the newspaper every year for her return. And Chloe kind of, I mean, I have great sympathy for her, but she tells herself that she could perhaps help and that she could revisit the story, investigate and bring this child home.
And it's set in and around Peterborough and Cambridgeshire. Why did you set it in this part of the world?
I'm from Peterborough, so that landscape's very familiar. And like I said, I started off at the Peterborough Evening Telegraph, and in those days, it was a really busy evening newspaper. There were 14 of us reporters. There was an archive where there was an archivist who would be cutting and filing away the stories for us reporters. And also, I needed a landscape that was also remote because of what happens eventually in the story when Chloe gets in touch with the family. So I needed to put her in a bleak landscape.
There's something about the landscape, isn't there, as well, that emphasises the isolation that she connects with.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it's funny because, you know, when I was a kid and I was growing up in that landscape, I found it so dull and so boring. And then when you revisit it as an adult and you see all that it has to offer and the beauty of it and the flora and fauna, it's a really interesting landscape. And it's really mysterious and creepy. And quite a few people have used it recently in their novels. So it's kind of having a moment. The Fens are having a moment.
And the story of a missing child, as a journalist, you probably covered stories of missing children.
Yeah, I have. I remember, I don't know if you remember the story of Sarah Payne, who went missing around 2000. And I remember covering that story and spending a lot of time with the family at the time. And it's only really since you've mentioned that I thought, oh yeah, of course I did. You know, I spent a lot of time with them and it was awful. It absolutely tore them apart. I mean, they had a resolution from their daughter missing, but how do people move on from these things? How do they reconcile what's happened? I don't know. I mean, I interviewed lots of parents who were grieving in the course of my days as reporters and as a reporter, and they've never left me those stories.
But you handle this very well in the book because it is a family grieving and it's a lost child story, but you haven't exploited it for melodrama. It's there and we focus on the grief and the absence.
Yeah, I mean, I really feel for Maureen and Patrick. They're the parents of Angie. I suppose it's a study as well on how people handle grief differently, and they have very different coping styles, which become apparent as the story unfolds. Some of the things that they say makes it sound like I didn't write it, but you know, it really gets to me when they talk about their grief. Is there something that we all experience? Hopefully not with regards to our children, but people do. And I think that people are so incredible to move on in the way that they have to from those kind of incidents.
And I found the portrayal of the local newspaper quite refreshing, actually, because normally when journalists are portrayed in fiction, they're door-stopping, they're unpleasant, they, you know, hold the front page. This is not a sleepy newspaper, but it just kind of gets on with the business. And as you say, she's an archivist, not the sexiest of jobs, but actually quite important.
Yeah, definitely important. I mean, I remember when I was a local reporter, we absolutely relied on that archive. We didn't have the internet. We couldn't Google stories or anything like that. So you had to go down to the archive and persuade the grumpy archivist to let you have the file and promise to take care of it, and then get told off when you didn't take it back when you should have done. And we really relied on things like that. And obviously now it's all gone digital. And in the book, the newspaper is moving to digital. So the story's set in around 2004 when newspapers were doing this, and I'd left local newspapers by then. You know, Chloe comments sometimes on the job of reporters and the fact that they get very close up to grief. And I remember being in people's houses, you know, hours after somebody had died. And it was a really special moment. It wasn't that kind of, you're not putting your foot in the door. These people wanted to talk. They wanted to have their loved one acknowledged, and they wanted to pay tribute to them. And I was only 18 or 19 then, but I always felt really privileged to be there in that moment. Also, I think in the Impostor, I kind of talk about the demise of the local newspaper, which I think is really, really sad. It's a real loss for our communities, but apparently it's progress.
Oh, is that why you set it in 2004? Because local newspapers were more important during that time?
Yeah, and also I didn't want a kind of presence of the internet. It needed to be in times before that. I don't know why, but she always arrived to me as an archivist, and she wouldn't be archiving now because that job is obsolete.
And that's Chloe you're talking about. Well, let's talk about Chloe. She's, I think it's safe to say, a classic unreliable narrator. It's told, not first person, but it's told principally from her point of view. Why did you decide to do it that way rather than have an omniscient narrator?
Well, I tried every single way. I wrote about 7 drafts of this book, and I tried it in third person and first person and past tense and present tense. And I went back and forth. I think I even did a bit of second. But can I just say, I have a little problem with this unreliable narrator thing.
No, go for it.
Because I think that we're all unreliable narrators. And so I don't think it's fair to say she's an unreliable narrator, because she's telling us how the world looks through her eyes. And so as far as she's concerned, she's absolutely reliable, as we all are, when we're telling everybody else how we see the world. So I take some issue with this idea of unreliable narrators, because if she's one, then so are we.
I suppose as a reader, we do cling on to the interaction she has, particularly with one of her oldest friends, Holly, who alludes to various things about various things that have gone on in the past. Those interactions with third people become quite important, don't they, as a way of fact checking, I suppose.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, Holly has quite a vital part in the story, but as you read further into it, yes, you're right. She does give you a little bit more. She colours in the picture more. of Chloe's background and Chloe's motivations.
And Chloe came to you as an archivist. Did she come, how fully formed did she come when you first thought of her?
I think that Maureen and Patrick and Angie were more fully formed than Chloe. She took a lot of getting into. I struggled with her, I have to say. But she wouldn't leave me. None of these people would leave me. That's the problem with these characters. They just get into your head and then they just don't go. And then you've got to figure out what they're doing there and what the story is. And like I said, when I was writing in the first person as Chloe, it's just too hard. I mean, considering my job is a ghostwriter, it sounds weird to say that. But she was too hard for me to get into her head. It was a bit weird in there.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? That you felt more comfortable doing that with real people, but with somebody fictional, it was more of a struggle.
Definitely.
Thank you, Anna. We'll come back to you in just a moment, but let's stay with fiction now. Let's hear from Anstey Harris. Anstey's first novel, The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton, came out in 2019. It was chosen for the Richard and Judy Book Club, and the Daily Express called it a powerful and passionate novel. The Museum of Forgotten Memories was published last year, and this month her third novel, Where We Belong, comes out in paperback. The Sunday Mirror called it tender and romantic, and Woman's Own said it was moving and beautifully crafted. When I spoke to Anstey, I asked her to tell me what the novel is about.
On the surface, it's about Kate and Leo, a mother and son who find themselves homeless and have nowhere to turn apart from Leo's father's family museum, which is a kind of half abandoned, crazy old Victorian pile in Kent. And Kate's desperate not to go there, and that's made even more the case when she meets the old family retainer, Araminta Buchan, who is far from pleased to see them, shall we say. And then it's just about how Kate and Leo manage to make it their home. Will they manage to make it their home? They have one summer before they're literally left with nowhere else to go. And it's about relationships, it's about secrets, it's about families, and it's about what makes us get along, what makes us tick, and what makes us belong.
So what genre is that for people? That sounds like, what is it?
It's aimed at book groups and the people who read book group books. The technical name for the genre is upmarket commercial women's fiction. It's a novel about love, although not necessarily romantic love, but it sits in another setting. It sits within various other issues that give it layers and give you something else to think about, something to learn, some people to learn about as well. People that you may have seen or you may imagine differently at the beginning of the book. I like there to be an element of reminding us that we don't know what it's like to be somebody until we have walked in their shoes and we literally understand everything about them.
And if it's book club fiction, so I know it's going to be discussed at book clubs. How does that affect you? Is that in your head when you're writing it?
No. I really like the fact, I feel very privileged about the fact that my books are discussed at book clubs. And actually, if you go onto my website, there's a button there, and I'm very happy to come and join you at your book group. It's one of the positives that's come out of the last year is the way that we've all adjusted to using Zoom, or lots of us have adjusted. What I usually do is I leave people to discuss the book first, warts and all, so they can say exactly what they want to. Then I come and join them for the last hour or so that they can ask any questions. I think all writers feel like that about book clubs. It's amazing that anybody would want to read your book, let alone discuss it with your friends. As I say, it's just such a privilege.
Well, I mean, talking about book clubs, you're into one of the biggest in the world, the Richard and Judy Book Club.
Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton. It was a Richard and Judy summer read as well, which is really thrilling. That's the one that people pick up at airports on their way to go on holiday. And literally when I started writing seriously, I've written all my life, but when I really started novel writing and hoping to make a living as a novelist, which is in about 2001, my actual goal, if anybody asked me, what do you want? My goal was to be a Richard and Judy author. Because I've always really liked the things they pick. I've always found them an appropriate measure of whether I'll enjoy the book or not. And I don't see myself as a Booker Prize author or anything of those. I don't write literary fiction. It's accessible fiction that deals with issues. And Richard and Judy is kind of like the prize within my genre. It certainly was for me. So I was thrilled, beyond thrilled, to be picked for that.
And what difference did it make to your career?
As so many things are, it's about validation, isn't it? It's that you've set yourself a goal and then you've worked quite hard and you've achieved it. And that's an amazing thing to happen to anybody in any line of work, because it's easy to forget that being a writer is actually a job. I mean, it's easy for other people to forget. It's quite hard for us to forget when we're weeping and banging our heads on the desk at 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was like getting the best kind of promotion you could get at work, or the employee of the year award from your demanding boss. It was great.
And you said that you like to, in your novels, celebrate uplifting news.
Yeah, definitely. Way back at the beginning of my career, my very first agent said to me that, certainly within my genre, you can write anything as gritty and as almost hard to read, if you like. You can explore any of those issues as long as you end on an uplifting note and you give people hope. That's one of the real blessings of fiction, isn't it? That you can come away with it full of hope. And so, yeah, I do try to do that. And I do. It's difficult to say what the issues are that I discuss in Where We Belong without spoilers. But there are some serious, serious issues in there. But you do come away, I hope, with a kind of renewed faith in humanity and an uplift.
And you're a writing tutor, you teach creative writing, and you're very interactive with writers on your website as well. You're always offering creative writing tips as well as your readers. That's important to you, feeling part of a community.
Definitely. And I think it's really important to promote other people's work. It's really important to put people together where you can. If you know somebody would benefit from meeting so-and-so, you know, all of those things all make the world go round. They're very useful for everybody. And there's no writer who couldn't do with a bit more promotion. It's hard to sell books. It really is. In teaching, I have to say, I learn something with every single lecture or lesson that I write for my students, because it's very easy after years and years of doing the thing to forget the very basics. And actually, all art, probably all science, literally sits on the basics. And without those, everything crumbles. And during lockdown, my students have really kept me going, because over Zoom, I have contact with about 25 people a week who I'm teaching in two groups. So it's a big group and it's really fun and everybody's sparking off each other. And it's felt like going to a party twice a week.
And has that kept you motivated to write during lockdown?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. I come away from every lesson thinking, oh, I could have done a bit more of this. And I go and sit down and write some more. The thing that's really motivated me during lockdown, because I have written my third novel during the two lockdowns, which I see myself as a massive achievement. But the thing that kept me going through it, or kept me working, was a thing called the London Writers Salon, who have a writer's hour. And you can Google London Writers Hour and it'll come up. It started off as two people who were writing together over Zoom a couple of times a day just to motivate themselves. And they opened it up to other people. And so now basically what happens is you log on, there's four sessions a day. You log on and there are about 300 people in a Zoom room with you and everybody's writing. And that's all you do. But you can see the other people and you can see them working. It really gave me accountability and it really gave me a structure. So anybody out there who's writing, whether you're doing short stories or novels or poetry, I heartily recommend the Writer's Hour for a bit of peer support.
And what's next for you then?
Well, my third novel, which is, it's a love story that stretches from the 1960s to the present day with a very big gap in the middle. And it's based around the peace protests at Faslane, outside Glasgow, in the 1960s, protesting against nuclear submarines moving into Scotland. I like to take an interesting setting. So my first novel, The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton, is about a violin maker. And then Where We Belong is set in a strange Victorian museum of taxidermy and anthropology. And then this one's set with a group of peace protesters. So I like to take a setting that will teach my reader something and bring them something new.
And Where We Belong by Anstey Harris is published by Simon and Schuster. We're talking today on Bookmark to Anna Wharton about her debut novel, The Imposter. Anstey there mentioning Richard and Judy. You have a Richard and Judy connection, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
You've got to tell. If you've got a Richard and Judy connection, you have to share.
Well, I met them years ago, 15 years ago or something. Basically, they were looking for a home for their book club and I was featured editor at Woman's Own then. So I offered them a home within the magazine and they had WH Smith's and they had a home in Woman's Own, which I think they may even still have, I'm not sure. And then they had a TV show, I think, as well. So yeah, I met them through that. I interviewed them. They've been super supportive always of my career and work. And they said some nice things about me, which you've read. And they also picked Wendy Mitchell, somebody I used to know, as their book club pick, which was wonderful. And Richard's an ambassador for the Alzheimer's Society. So that worked for him as well, I think. So yeah, they're great. I think they're brilliant. I would obviously absolutely love The Imposter to be one of their picks, but I will leave that down to fate.
And I think the Richard and Judy Book Club is really interesting because they managed to get that balance between choosing popular fiction that can also be literary fiction. And, you know, they've had some quite challenging things on that list. Some people are sniffy about it, but actually, personally, I always use it as a good guide to something that's going to give you a bit of meat. There's lots of substance in what they choose.
They're brilliant champions of books. I think they have real authority. I think they have a really good mixture of fiction in there. And long may they continue to do so.
And Anstey talking about addressing the big issues in her book. And there are big issues in this novel as well, aren't there? We've mentioned dementia, loss, grieving, care system. You're looking at some big things in The Imposter.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I suppose that it's interesting because the character of Nan, who has dementia in the book, she came to me right at the last minute. She didn't exist at all until draft 7. But I think she's so important in the book. She's so vital. And I wanted to show as well that often people rely on cliches when it comes to dementia. And it's really important to show things that you can do to help people with dementia. And there are things in there that Chloe does to help Nan live better with dementia. So I think that you could find some useful things in there. But just the care and attention that Chloe shows her, and also this idea of, do we really need to keep bringing people with dementia back into our reality if they are in that moment living another reality? Is it really necessary to keep saying, no, sorry, so-and-so died, you know, and upsetting them all over again? Because in that moment, if they are living in a different reality, that would be like putting us on Mars, you know. It's just so different to them to pull them out of that. And I think Chloe recognises that more than anybody, which is really interesting because she's lived among these stories that she does get rather attached to while she's doing her job. So she understands that sometimes all of us just need to have a story to tell ourselves, to live with ourselves, to live better with ourselves. And it's interesting that she recognises that and likens it to dementia.
And what kind of research did you do on issues like that?
Well, of course, I wrote a book about dementia.
Of course.
In fact, I've written two now because Wendy and I have just completed a second one of hers. So yeah, that was easy for me, that part of the research. I did research on Chloe's character, but I have to be careful what I tell you about that because I don't want to give anything away.
No, don't give anything away.
The newspaper, obviously, I'd lived that because I'd worked there. The setting I'd lived. And the grieving parents, I had spent lots of time with grieving parents.
So it was all leading you there. Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Hey Boy, Hey Girl by the Chemical Brothers. Why this one?
This is my absolute motivation music. I did a TED talk a few years ago. And I mean, I've done lots of live TV, breakfast TV this morning, GMTV as a kind of talking head. But I was absolutely terrified of this TED talk, so terrified. And the only way I could get through it when I woke up in the morning was to put this song on repeat and just play it over and over again to kind of psych myself up. And so now this is my go-to whenever I feel a bit daunted by something. I just stick this on, try and get some guts from somewhere.
Hey girls, hey boys, superstar DJs. Here we go! Hey girls,
Cambridge 105 Radio.
In 1960s Cambridge, you might have shopped at Joshua Taylor, gone roller skating at the Corn Exchange, and seen the Beatles perform live at the Regal Cinema. On Sunday mornings, John Gannon takes you back in time with hits and memories from the swinging decade. John Gannon's 60s Scene, Sundays at 8 a.m. on the station that's live and local, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Looking to buy a new home this summer, but it feels out of reach? Then getting on the property ladder just isn't an option for you. Think again. New homes in Haverhill and Cottenham are available now with shared ownership, with your mortgage deposit as low as from £4,000. The final 2 and 3 bedroom homes at Bower Place and Boyton Place also have exclusive incentive packages available worth over £2,500. With £1,000 shopping vouchers, £500 towards your solicitor's fees, and 3 months rent free, book your viewing today to find out what's on offer. Reserve from just £99 and find your new home this summer. Think shared ownership. Think Complete Moves. Visit complete-moves.co.uk or call 020 3640 7111 today. Terms and conditions apply.
Need dropping off at work? Missed the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Rather than books.
And we're talking on Bookmark today to Anna Wharton about her debut novel, The Imposter. Anna, at the centre, really, of The Imposter, though we never see her, is the missing child, Angela. How much was she real to you?
That's a really good question. In fact, it was only the other day that I remembered that I had written in one draft in her voice. I'd written of the moment that she went missing. And I'd completely forgotten that because, like I said, there's been so many drafts. She was 4 when she went missing. My daughter was 2 when I started writing this book, and she's nearly 9 now. Seems strange to me that I was writing a book about a girl similar age to my girl going missing. I suppose I wanted to know what happened to Angie. I've got a very clear picture of her in my head, and I've described her in the book, in the photographs, and described her school and some other bits from the cuttings as well. And I have a very clear view in my mind of Angie. And like you said, but she's kind of haunts the book. And yet we never, ever know her, only through the eyes of other people.
These stories of missing children, they trigger this emotion in people, don't they? And there is an element of obsession in the novel, Chloe's obsession with finding out what happened to her, and Maureen, Angela's mother's obsession, understandably, with trying to find out what happened to her. And I wondered if that somehow reflected our obsession as people with stories like Sarah Payne, Madeleine McCann, that there's something just innately wrong about it, and we need to find out more to correct it somehow.
I think what I was interested in as well was this no man's land, exploring this no man's land that they're living in, Maureen and Patrick, because they don't know, they can't move on. And I know how difficult it is for parents to move on. You know, I think Maureen at one point talks about, you know, she felt guilty for smiling or laughing after Angie went missing. I think she says to Chloe, can you imagine that? Feeling guilty for putting a smile on your face. But I could so understand that. It's absolutely horrendous. And they had no conclusion to this story. So they're sort of trapped in this time warp, Maureen and Patrick. They just can't And he, and like I said before, he handles it very differently to her. But I've witnessed that. I've witnessed that within, like, Sarah Payne's family, how different they were. Lots of people throw themselves into campaigning. And so, yes, in that way, it becomes an obsession. But they just feel that they have to stay close. Of course you do. You have to stay close and you have to keep this memory alive. And Maureen and Patrick do these articles in the newspaper every year, plead for further information. They don't want to move on. You wouldn't want to move on, but you have to, I guess, in that situation.
Well, there is something about time in the novel, isn't there? About whether you're living in the present or the past, mm-hmm. and can you look to the future? I mean, you've got, as you say, Nan with dementia, mm-hmm. who lives in all kinds of time frames. Chloe, who's influenced by what happened to her in her past, and Patrick and Maureen, who were very stuck in a certain moment.
I mean, all of those characters, apart from Nan, bless her, because it's a bit difficult for her, but they could do with moving on from the past, really. I like to think that they would, but I'll leave that for the reader to decide.
Thank you, Anna. Well, let's go to the past now, actually, and hear from Louis Elsher. He's a Professor Emeritus of German History at the Rochester Institute of Technology in New York. Traitors or Patriots, a story of the German anti-Nazi resistance, came out earlier this year. Pacific Book Review called it excellent, and Kirkus Reviews described it as accessible yet comprehensive. When I spoke to Louis, who lives in New York, I asked him to tell me a little more about the book.
It is about the anti-Nazi movement inside of Germany, especially during World War II. We in the West know almost nothing about this. And I think it's a story that needs to be told. There's a strong moral dimension to this thing of men. I use the term men advisedly because there were almost no women directly involved in the affair. But these were men who were trying to enhance their own interests, and they gave support to Hitler. It's much like what's going on in this country today with the Republican Party and Donald Trump. They don't give one whit about the welfare of the nation. All they care about is themselves. And that's the way several of these generals within the army behaved. Two, maybe three or four top generals who refused to join the resistance movement inside the army. In some cases, it cost them their lives, and it certainly cost Germany a very high price.
Was that why you wanted to tell this story, the kind of moral imperative? Was that what drove you to research and write this?
Well, the thing that really drew me into this was my own ethnicity, which is probably 90% German. My paternal grandmother and grandfather were born in Bavaria and in Austria. And my mother's family had come over to America in the late 17th century, but I have every reason to believe they were German because the names were all German. Well, I was in very early teens in the war. I began to think that there was something in my genes or in my veins that would prompt me to follow a man like Adolf Hitler. There was a lot of propaganda in this country that promoted that idea. I mean, the Germans were the real nasty guys from the perspective of the United States. And here I am, a 12, 14-year-old kid, absorbing all of this stuff on the newspapers and in the radio. I think, is there something wrong with me that would prompt me to adopt a Nazi attitude? So the motivation for writing it was really self-interest.
Yes, you've spoken about seeking to reconcile your German heritage with the atrocities committed by Nazi Germany. You've spoken mm-hmm. about that. Writing this book was, in a way, that part of that reconciling process. Did that help?
Yes, because the anti-Nazi resistance in Germany was much stronger than most people know. The Germans, or the Nazis, I should say, never got a majority of votes in the Reichstag. The best they ever did was in 1932, when they got 38% of the popular vote. And even the following year in 33, there was a very carefully choreographed election that was controlled entirely by the Nazis. And even at that point, they only got 44% of the vote. I think that says an awful lot about the attitude of the German people toward the Nazis in 1933 and 34.
The people who were the resistance, what do we know about them? We don't know much about them generally. What do you know about them?
Well, they came from all walks of life, from single individuals doing their best to try to eliminate Hitler, to large sections of the army. The key really was the army, because that was the only group of people who could get direct access to Hitler. And they came very, very close on several occasions, but they weren't able to do it.
And we know they didn't kill him, but did they make a difference? Do you think things would have been different somehow if they hadn't existed?
I don't think it would have made that much difference, because Hitler had total control. Remember, he had a secret police and he had a private army. So I just don't see anything being any different without the resistance.
And what were your major sources of research for this?
Well, I don't refer to this book as a scholarly book because I have no original resources. This is all based on secondary sources, articles and books.
Presumably there are descendants of people who were resistance.
Yes, there were. There were, well, certainly there were members of the family that were aware of the subject. Of course, many of the people were murdered by the Nazis. Many of the resistors were arrested and executed by the Nazis. They just didn't live to tell the story. They left a lot of personal memorabilia, personal notes, letters, and so forth and so on. And that's what these prior researchers acquired. When I started out, there was a significant number of books that dealt in with various phases, various topics within this anti-Nazi movement. But there was nothing that I could find that brought it all together. And that's what I tried to do, is bring all the various elements together to tell one broad story.
And did they ever stand a chance, do you think? Was there a moment where they got really close to it? If things had been different, then, well, the whole course of history would be different. Could they have done it?
They came within hours of eliminating Hitler in a couple of instances. For example, there was one instance when Hitler, for some reason, had to go to the Soviet Union. Well, a couple of the resistance officers were able to acquire a bomb that they put on the plane that Hitler flew into the Soviet Union. And it was scheduled to explode after they had reached their altitude of, I don't know how many thousand feet, 15, 18,000 perhaps. And they waited and they waited and they waited to get news. You can imagine the stress that they were under. Well, they got word that the plane had landed safely in Germany. Well, what happened? It turned out that the bomb was placed in the luggage compartment of the plane, and the weather was too cold for the bomb to function. So they were probably within a couple thousand feet of killing the man. And there were some other episodes that were quite similar to that in their general picture.
So they didn't have luck on their side by the sound of it?
No. One of the most spectacular misses occurred in the fall of 1939. And Hitler, he would give a speech on the eve of November the 9th at a place called the Bierbräukeller in Munich. And he did that to commemorate an attempt he had made in 1923 to seize power. There was an individual man, a lone patriot, shall we say. He worked in a stone quarry and he was able to get explosives. And he built his own bomb and put it in the beer hall, set the bomb to explode a little after 9 o'clock in the evening. He was there, but of course he got out of the building. Everybody that knew about it was waiting for the bomb to explode. And it didn't explode when it was supposed to. Hitler finished his speech about 9 o'clock, almost exactly 9 o'clock, but he left early. He usually stayed around to talk with some of the old fighters, the old friends he had. But this particular night, he left early, right after his speech. And exactly 13 minutes after he left, the bomb exploded, killed a significant number of people. And had he been on the speaker's dais at that particular time, he would have died. But he didn't. He escaped it. That's the center of the whole story of this anti-Nazi movement. Hitler himself claimed that he had 42 attempts on his life. And there were some secret organizations, too, that tried to dispatch him. But it never worked.
Did those near misses in some way make him feel, must have made him feel immortal? Did they make him feel even stronger in some way? Did backfire in that sense?
Oh, yes, that's right. He felt that he was being protected by some supernatural being that was saving him for a final victory, which, of course, never came. Yeah, that's an interesting dimension to this whole thing. I think he used the word providence. Providence was watching over him. Somebody seemed to be watching over him. I don't know what it was or who it was, but this was a central piece as part of the whole story.
Traitors or Patriots, a story of the German anti-Nazi resistance by Louis Elcher, is published by Macnida and Grace. We've been talking today on Bookmark to Anna Wharton about her debut novel, The Imposter, which is published by Mantle. So, Anna, what's next for you now, then?
I'm working on another novel at the moment, but it's quite different, and it's at very early stages, but it's come to me quite fully formed, so I'm excited about it. And I've been doing lots of translating from Turkish to English. I've been reading these Turkish books because the information that I'm mining is inside them, and while I do have a grasp of Turkish, it's certainly not good enough to read whole books. So it's really stretching my brain a bit doing this, but I'm very excited about it. But it's very different. It's not in the same genre. And I don't know what else.
Oh, no, that's quite exciting. And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, I'm reading The Second Place by Rachel Cusk. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it, actually. I found her for a long time her writing quite difficult to penetrate, and then about a month or two ago I just read everything of hers. I kind of had a week where I just read,
binged,
and I read six of her books, and so I now feel that I have a grasp of how she writes and the theme she writes on, and so I'm kind of finding really, really interesting thoughts embedded within her work. And she's just so super clever. I mean, this is a problem. She just makes you feel really thick. Because she's so clever. And so, yeah, I'm reading that, and I'm trying to get it out of the way. Not out of the way, because I'm really enjoying it, but Deborah Levy's book I have on pre-order, and it's arriving tomorrow. So I want to finish Rachel Cusk so I can also read that as soon as it arrives, because I just love both of those women. So, yeah.
I can see how excited you are about that. It's great to see such excitement about books.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm just complete geek, really.
Well, thank you, Anna. We'll come back to you in a moment for your last choice of music, but a heads up on next show. So that's kind of historical theme to the next show. Our featured guest is James Boyce, talking about his book, Imperial Mud, The Fight for the Fens, A History of the Fenlands. We'll also speak to Jane Taylor about her novel, The Spinning House Affair, which is set in 19th century Cambridge. And Rafe Cormack will be chatting about Midnight in Cairo, about the women who shaped Egypt's astonishing 1920s cabaret scene. Something for everyone in there. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Anna, which is Golden Retriever by Super Furry Animals. Why this one?
I wrote a short story about 3 years ago. I wrote this story called Golden Retriever. This is kind of what I was saying earlier about how these stories come and they won't leave. The characters from this short story will not leave me. But even the other day I said to my friend, I can't stop thinking about Derek. And bear in mind, I have a cat called Derek. She knew exactly who I meant. She was like, from the story a few years ago, that's the sign of a good friend.
And a good cat, actually.
So Golden Retriever is nothing to do with this story. The story is really dark, actually. But because it's called Golden Retriever and because this song's called Golden Retriever, I just listen to it all the time as my kind of theme tune, not while writing.
Of course.
Never. No, but yeah, so I thought, well, there's a link to writing there with this Golden Retriever. He said the devil.